Welcome to Equestrian Movement's Best Do No Harm podcast. I'm your host, Katie Boniface, co-founder of Equestrian Movement with Sarah Gallagher. We work with horse riders who want to build a stronger bond and a deeper connection with their horses. In our first Do No Harm podcast, we discuss with other industry professionals how to work with horses to firstly do no harm and secondly support their mental, emotional and physical well-being throughout the training process, so that we have horses that enjoy learning and ask to be ridden. Each episode, we discuss the different influences our training can have and how we can improve our horses' overall athleticism, soundness of mind and body, and emotional fortitude, while strengthening and deepening our relationship with our horses. Each week, I will endeavour to bring to you a new episode on horse riding, training, handling and husbandry, or an interview with other industry professionals to help you address where and why you might get stuck in creating the beautiful union of dancing souls that is the equestrian sport. Are you ready to kick off today's show? Let's get started. Hey team, Katie here from Equestrian Movement, and today we're going to talk about join up. It's been a while since we've had this conversation, so I thought, why not kick it off again? It's one of the first episodes that we have, probably the most listened to episode as well. And seeing so join up is such a foundational exercise in horsemanship, I thought I would also delve into my personal experiences with it and where the exact experience that made me reconsider using it and how I've adapted to the work and was able to relearn the purpose from the horse's eyes. So let's get started. We can't start this conversation without me going into detail about my beautiful horse King, who was my third horse. He ultimately was the first ever heart horse that I had, and he opened me up to such a rich experience of what it's like to work with a horse that's experienced trauma and what is required from you as a human to be a supportive, compassionate leader when working with your horse. And he ultimately was the trigger for my evolution from moving from a mechanical push button way of riding with horses to trying to find a way of communicating with them. Horses that have experienced trauma are really wired differently, and when you've worked with them, you can kind of start to see how they're just a bit different, and you have to really pay attention to what a horse needs to feel safe to be able to engage safely with them. I've had quite a few horses in my life where we've known their whole life experience, and we know that they've had a good life. They've not been mistreated, they've not been abused, they've really known love and care from their humans and lived a good herd-based lifestyle. And they are a very different breed, a very different variety to our horses that have experienced trauma. I used to think, after working with King, that working with the horses that have experienced trauma were easier, because all you needed to do was make them feel safe and then they'd be incredibly compliant and cooperative with everything that you wanted to do. The horses that, you know, had grown up with a very easy life and a very loving home and a very safe environment with their humans, they seemed harder to work with than these horses that had experienced trauma, because when I look at it now, they were really challenging me to evolve how I interacted with them, because just feeling safe is not enough when it comes to training. You really want to rethink the tools that you're using and how you engage with the horse to motivate them to participate in their training sessions. And just relying on pressure release and escalating pressure, that's the only tool in your toolkit, you will end up inevitably and consistently in conflict with your horse, especially if they understand that felt sense of safety and that felt sense of belonging that allows them to say, hey, I'm not okay with you doing that. That doesn't motivate me. So King was his own whole experience, and I was lucky enough to have him before I was introduced to horsemanship, because I think you know, the idea of what we're trying to achieve through horsemanship can really get lost and filtered down into, you know, the black and white application of exercises. What can you make your horse do? Instead of how are you going to use these exercises to build a language with your horse, to build a felt sense of safety and belonging with your horse, and to give your horse trust and confidence in you to follow your lead. And then in a way that also allows you to develop trust and confidence in your horse, because everything starts to become more predictable and reliable when we have this good relationship and good communication skills between us. So King was fabulous in that he sat me on my ass every time I, you know, used too much pressure or was too high energy or escalated things too far. He would just straight up dump me. And that was really helpful. It helps you check yourself before you wreck yourself. It helps you rein in a little your enthusiasm for what you want to achieve and to consider the horse's experience of what you're doing before you ask them to do things. So we didn't know King's history when we got him. We bought him as a show horse, as my third show horse to go out and compete on, to travel nationally for states and championships, and he just was a mess when we got him. I couldn't get the bridle on. He taught me this really cool trick because he'd obviously had his ears and his muzzle wrung. He was very head shy, so you couldn't touch his nose or his ears. So trying to get a bridle or a halter on was very difficult to begin with. And so we kind of over time developed a way of working together where he could anticipate what I was going to do and what I was asking him to do, and then he could do it for himself. For example, I would hold the halter out and he'd put his own nose in. I'd hold the bridle, so I had to undo the cheek piece so that the bit was dropped, and I'd hold the bridle out so that he could put his own ears between the headpiece and the brow band, and then I'd pick the bit up for him to put his own mouth onto the bit and then do the cheek piece up so that I wasn't touching his nose or his mouth to put the bit in, and so that I wasn't touching his ears to put the headpiece over his ears. So obviously we didn't get there straight away. This is like a whole year of trying to figure out how to work with this horse, and his nose weren't just like refusal and resistance. They were like explosions of rears and like leaping in the air and bolting. I couldn't tie him up. I have very vivid memories of him dragging my granddad down the alleyway because he got a fright and granddad was trying to hold on to him. He would be the one at Pony Club that we couldn't hard tie to the float. And every now and then he'd just get a bee in his bonnet and then he'd be loose in the Pony Club grass. So he could be a little bit of the mischief maker that got us a bit of a bad reputation sometimes. I was the only one that could catch him, and you had to be very intentional about how you approached him, very aware of his body language and how you moved towards him. You had to notice he had to stop and stand still and notice like a slight lowering of the head. That was his cue to consent you to come further. You had to approach him at the exact same angle every time. You know, he had to be in the place of his paddock where he felt safe as you approached. It had to be the same every single time, so he felt safe to know what to expect and to anticipate it. And he was also the one that taught me that, just even like high energy, like excitement, is enough to trip the horses up as well. So it's one thing to like not feel scared on the back of the horse, but getting excited is the same energy. And he had this beautiful buck technique where he'd throw me off and he'd land me on my back and he'd wind me, and I was dying every time. And so we were going through this process, you know, for a good year, getting to know each other. It all sounds very exhausting when I say this out loud. But it was an incredibly valuable experience for me to learn how to make a horse feel safe, because he needed nothing less than that. He needed to be safe before I did anything with him, and he needed to feel that sense of belonging before I could do anything with him. So we get a year into training this wild beast that I owned that was supposed to be, you know, my competition horse that I was going to, you know, tour Australia with. And we get out to our first competition and one of the ladies there goes, "Oh, I recognize that horse. Used to be on the rodeo circuit." I was like, "Oh, wow, that really explains everything, right down to his perfect buck technique." So it was really that eye-opener of, I know not every horse comes out of the Bronx circuit with trauma, but something had happened to him that had created that experience. And these horses that have experienced trauma, they always need that felt sense of safety and belonging. But even when they have that, they still know where their exit is. And so you can't have them feel pinned. You can't have them, you know, have too many people crowd them. You can't move too quickly around them. You have to be very safe and predictable and consistent and routine. Otherwise, they trip up and they're in their self-protect and defense mechanism straight away. The good thing is that quite often their choice is to run instead of attack, but there are also some horses that can have this trauma and attack and be aggressive instead first. And then these horses, when they do feel trapped, they will lash out and attack to try and escape that experience of being trapped. So needless to say, he was his own experience. And he, you know, as much as we can say that the behaviors were very unsafe and difficult, he enriched my life so much and gave me so much and taught me so much. And after a period of time, what would happen is he started following me around. So because I couldn't tie him up, it meant that when I'd go to put his tack away, he'd walk with me to the tack room. When I'd go to bring his tack out, he'd walk with me to the tack room to bring the tack out. When I'd put the brushes away, like anywhere I was moving around in the paddock, he would just follow me like a lap dog. And what that also meant is that whenever I saw that brace where he stopped following me, I knew that it was a cue that he felt unsafe and I need to stop and wait and allow him to process before I was to proceed with the next thing. And so whilst I didn't get taught this by any trainers or coaches, it was really King and his experience of trauma that was able to shape who I have become as a trainer and how we teach the way that we teach. And it became foundational to the way that I was retraining and breaking horses and teaching riders to engage with horses. You've got to look for the brace. The brace means they feel unsafe. And if you push that, then you're going to see behaviors that are an expression of that lack of felt sense of safety and belonging. With all of the horses that I ride, I want it to be their choice that I sit on their back, because when it's not, it hurts. When they're quite happy to throw you on the ground and tell you to get off, I don't want to do that anymore. So whenever I'm riding an unknown horse or even my own horses, or I've got a horse in on training, everything is done at liberty, consent based. We've got trainings in this on our YouTube channel, but it goes from, you know, grooming to leading up from the barn to tacking up and bridling. It's all done without a halter, so that they have permission to say no. Moving to the mounting block, they have permission to say no and not be pushed or rushed through what they're being asked to do, so that I know that it's all a yes. So that by the time I'm on their back, I know that they've yesed my request to ride them. And so by the time I'm riding them and we're working together, I know that they've said yes to that request. And so it can mean that I have a lot more trust and confidence in the horse to not throw me off, because we've already got that open dialogue. But the horse also has more trust and confidence in me because they know that I'm hearing their no's and we're finding a mutual language to negotiate how that's going to become a yes. So whether that means time, space, patience, sometimes treats, praise, reward, you know, whatever it looks like, is what the horse is going to receive with that no. Doesn't mean that they're a naughty horse. It could just mean not like that. Not right now. I don't understand. My brain is too boggled from what we've already done so far. I need a break, or I need to stop altogether for the day. Being able to have that open dialect and that open communication and conversation with the horse means that you can then allow the horse the psychological safety to set their own boundaries and parameters for how you engage with them. And so over time, that trust and that confidence builds in each other. And then we can, you know, we can ask more, and they can give more because it's on their terms, and they can communicate when we need to stop. And so all of that education came from King and his trauma experience. All of the education I received from coaches was about to release, escalating pressure, pushing the horse into performance, asking more of them, you know, more forward, more frame, more bend, jump higher, rep, rep, rep. Their horse box, make sure you smack it because it's being naughty and it's being unsafe and it's being dangerous. So all of those things, you know, they take away from that communication with the horse, and they do lead to the whole process looking like argument and conflict. Now, obviously, there are some really good trainers and coaches out there, and I did learn a lot from my trainers and coaches, but it really wasn't the relationship part that I learned from them. The relationship and connection part came from the horses. And that's what I teach all of my students at the moment. I say, imagine you are going to Japan, you're in Japan, you can't speak Japanese, and you're in a math class. Are you going to be able to learn math? No, because you don't even know the language. So you need to think about that when you're with the horse. Is, let's say you're in that Japanese class and there's an English translator there. They're not actually teaching you the math. They're just translating what the math teacher is teaching. But it gives you more potential to learn the math because now you can speak the language. That's all my role is. My role is the translator to, bridge that communication barrier between horse and rider. The horse is the one that's teaching, and I'm just helping you understand what the horse is saying, and hopefully you'll get better at it than me. That's the ultimate goal. I want you teaching me what your horse is telling me, especially if it's your horse. So after King, well, I had King until he passed away. I was lucky enough and grateful enough to be able to give him his forever home, and he stayed with me. Aside from a couple of stints of being leased out, he stayed with me until the end of his days, and he passed across the Rainbow Bridge, which was such an honor to be able to offer him that safety for the rest of his life. In the meantime, I was, you know, in my 20s, and I was studying to be a coach and trying to be a competitive participant in the industry and doing training and breaking. And I really fell down and got pushed into the rabbit hole of pressure release, escalating pressure to get submission, release of pressure to mark and motivate. And it was challenging because it really creates that disconnect. It really starts to make you feel unsafe working with the horse. It makes you start to lose trust and confidence in yourself and your horse. And it makes you start to really hate who you are as a rider and a trainer and how you work with the horse. And it's how I ended up getting fired by my coach, was that I just couldn't keep riding if that was the way that I was to keep riding. I did use Join Up fairly successfully when I was working with the horses, and not because of the practical implementation of the 1-2-3 step of Join Up, but because of what King had taught me of how to soften the ask, how to invite them to approach you, how to make them feel safe in space with you, how to send them away in a way that was not threatening and intimidating to them. Those subtleties that come in relationship to a horse, where you're not just communicating the thing that you want them to do, you're also communicating them how you're going to show up in relationship to them, how you're going to ask things of them, and how you're going to give them time and space to process the ask, setting up a sequence of events so that they can learn what's expected of them and anticipate the ask. And all of those things culminate to give them that felt sense of safety because they can have that anticipation of what's going to happen to them. At the same time, I was watching other trainers doing it quite poorly, triggering the horse into a flight response, making them feel unsafe, showing them that they couldn't escape the round yard, couldn't escape the pressure, not being clear in what the correct answer was. One trainer local to us ended up with the horse tying up with azotria because they'd just run it so hard in the heat trying to get the submission state from the horse where they finally turn in and give to you. They were not driving the horse in a state of fear around us, and we're not driving them from that state of fear into a state of forfeiting the will to live. And that can be how the breaking process is interpreted by some people to create a safe horse. Breaking their spirit, breaking their will to live, handing over the control, that we now have control of what happens to them. There's a few reasons why that is a problem. If we can assume that, well, we can't assume, if we could say that that had any potential, it now means that the horse can't make any decisions for itself. And so the horses are responsible for their own fate. If we are riding them, our horse needs to be aware of its balance and its feet and where it's going so that it can move safely, avoid obstacles, navigate, you know, dips and potholes and different things in the ground so that they have the confidence to keep their footing and their balance. We can't do that for them. And I think that if you're doing a lot of arena riding, that's something that you really miss, is like when you're out and you're hacking on a trail or you're cross country venting, something along those lines, the horse needs to be very responsible and interdependent of us, that they can sort their balance out and they can sort out where their feet go so that they don't do themselves a mischief. All we're doing is giving them the direction. We're going this direction at this speed. And even to that point is that the horse can still tell us what direction it needs to go to navigate the obstacles safely and at what speed they need to go to navigate the obstacles. So there has to be a back and forth, a team, an interdependence of allowing to the horse to tell us what they need to navigate these challenges with success, and us being able to tell them, you know, what we're kind of trying to achieve and what we're aiming towards. And so this is another place where our compassionate leadership skills and our psychological safety is going to come up, is that the horse can't just blindly follow our lead without consequence of how that's going to impact them, their choices, and their body. But we also can't let our horses make all the choices for us because our horses don't make good life choices. So there's a back and forth, an ebb and flow of how we give direction, how the horse receives direction, the feedback that we get for how what the horse needs to navigate what we're doing with them. And we're looking for that flow in conversation. But in saying that, I can see, you know, the reason to want to use Join Up, because it can be very effective. I have used it a lot successfully, and it's developed a good language with the horses of being able to send them out and call them in. And also just to, you know, if they need to run their sillies out, they have permission to run their sillies out without being scared of me as the trainer or, you know, the driving tool or whatever it is that I'm using. However, the 1, 2, 3, you know, application of that exercise is not what drives the connection. It's not what, you know, drives the horse to seek you for direction. It's not the thing that makes the horse want to look after you and to keep you safe, and it's not what gets the horse to seek you for direction. They can learn how to seek the release of pressure, but they have done studies to show that you can get the same results with a remote control. car. So doing that hooking on process with a join up hooking on process with a remote control car can give you the same results of the horse following the car as doing it as a person. So there's not an emotional connection there. It's just that associative learning of if I follow the car, then it's going to stop chasing me. If I follow the human, then the human will stop driving me and making me run. And that's the thing that I don't want. The experience that really started to make me question the application of join up for getting the horse to hook on and building that connection and that rapport with the horse, because I did use it for a good couple of years as a trainer, was an experience that I had with a little Arab stallion where any of you have used join up and you know how to get that. There's that moment in time where you can see that the horse is about to soften and give and turn into you. I was seeing that moment in time, and with the anticipation of the softening and giving and turning into me, the stallion actually ran at me and picked me up by the neck and threw me on the ground. I was incredibly lucky to have three jumpers on because it was the middle of winter, so he just tore my jumpers. But you know, for a stallion, that is a kill tactic for them, and that's what he was trying to do. The pressure that I was putting on him, not being able to give him an escape route, not creating a felt sense of safety and belonging, and not having these tools for communication at his disposal and the emotional agility tools, meant that instead of giving to me, instead of submitting to me, he attacked me for fear of threat. What the other thing that was happening at that time that I didn't know about was that he was also at another trainer who was training him purely for his show performance, and his method of working with stallions was to beat them at their knees until they went down onto their knees, and that was his form of submission. So this stallion, you know, was getting handled like this by one person, and without me knowing, I was trying to get like this softer version of connection and working together with him. And so he was very lost and confused in what that was going to look like for him. And so instead of softening to me, that whole experience triggered a reflex of feeling threatened and attacking me instead. And so in that moment, I didn't know any of these things, but it really made me start to question why in that moment, instead of giving and softening to me, did he attack me? And so I could see that over time, it was because of the pressure that's created in that join up situation to establish that hooking on process, where you're driving the horse away from you, but not giving them an outlet to actually escape you. So you're, you know, done poorly, you're making the horse run away from you with fear without actually giving them a way to get away from you. So they're just going to go round and round in circles. Yes, the goal is to have them learn how to seek the release of pressure, but we have to remember that if we're in threat survival part of the brain, we're not able to solve problems, we're not able to think through things, we're just reacting to our experience. So he's not truly going to learn, you know, how to seek the release of pressure in other situations as a form of communication if he's really just receiving that driving part of the join-up session as a threat perceived, a fear, a need for survival. And at the time, I was trying all I had up my sleeve in the way of connection and relaxation skills. And I'm not sure if I ever would have got there with him, even if the other trainer hadn't have been working with him, because I was also having my own kind of identity crisis or crisis of trainer at the time, in that I couldn't offer this felt sense of safety and belonging at that time because I was becoming fearful for the future of the horses. you know, I'd had so much experience and so much industry knowledge that even a really good, well-behaved horse can end up at the doggers. And so I was starting to bring that fear for the horse's future into the training sessions. And I think that that was also having an influence over how well the horses were able to engage in their learning and their training. And that's what we're talking about in our holistic horse handling of our compassionate leadership, how we show up for our horses, how we engage with our horses, how our horses are receiving and perceiving how they are experiencing us. Even though we can have the 1, 2, 3, 4 ticky-tacky, this is the box, operant conditioning, black and white, we're still working with an emotive, sentient, intelligent being capable of, you know, putting their own experiences and their own perception on the training experience for themselves. So that was the beginning of a returning to who I was as a person, as a trainer, when I was working with King. You know, I went through my own kind of crisis of identity coming through that experience as being a trainer and breaker, where I had people telling me that this soft way of working with the horses was unsafe and I was creating dangerous horses. And I didn't want that. I didn't want it for horses and I didn't want it for the people I was working with. So I was using these skills that I was learning, thinking that that's what I needed to create safe horses. And inadvertently, I had one of the most dangerous experiences of my life with horses that made me question everything I knew. So what I was able to recognize was that I had with King a hooking on experience where I didn't do join up and I didn't force that follow to get him to hook on with me. It was how he had experienced me, how he felt safe with me, and how he was seeking me for direction that allowed for this hooking on where he was following me at liberty. And so that's what we work towards recreating with our holistic horse handling program, and that's what we recreate within our face-to-face lessons at Equestrian Spirit, where it's not about chasing the horse into submission. It's about being able to call their attention onto you, invite them to follow you, and how you're going to keep that attention on you and keep them following you and seeking you for direction through your different asks that you're going to ask of them. So I hope that gives you some insight into how we approach join up as holistic horse handlers. I'm neither for nor against it. I do, however, only use it as a general lunging tool at liberty. I don't necessarily need the horses to be in a round yard. I'm quite happy for them to be in an open paddock. And it's more about the conversation around calling their attention onto you, how you're going to send them away from you in a way that is not triggering a flight reflex, and how you're going to call them back into you. That's it from me for today. Until next time, happy trails. If you're starting to realize that escalating pressure and having pressure release is the only tool in your toolkit inevitably results in conflict and manhandling your 500 kilo plus fur baby, you have to check out our free masterclass, Say Yes to a Happy Willing Horse. There is an art and a science to everything we do with our horses. The science is the undeniable behavioral training and manipulation of the internal chemistry, neurotransmitters, and hormones. Hello, dopamine! The art is in the connection and the relationship. How your horse behaves is a reflection of who they are in relationship to you, how they receive your instruction, and how safe you make them feel to follow your lead. And if you didn't want that, ride a motorbike. We know that our horses are emotive, intelligent, sentient beings that are aware of the manipulative, coercive, and sometimes abusive tactics used to force them to cooperate. And we can seek a better way. The foundations of holistic horse handling are nervous system regulation, compassionate leadership, communication, and emotional agility. These elements are critical to have a handle on before going to work with your horse, so that we can develop the psychological safety for the horse to communicate how the training can be of benefit to them. Our training should be happening for them, not to them. If we want a horse that we can have trust and confidence in and that seeks to look after us first, we need to create an environment where learning is fun, movement feels good, and our horse is asked to be ridden. This sounds impossible to you, know that it's not. It's a reality hundreds of our students have achieved. It just requires coming home and a relearning of what we lost due to peers, coaches, trainers, and other influences teaching us that that kind of softness and kindness creates unsafe horses. In truth, it is the opposite. To create safe, willing horses, we first need to create a felt sense of safety and a felt sense of belonging. We need to be strategic and intentional how we set the horse up for success, so as not to overface ourselves and our horses, and we need to create experiences where we build trust and confidence in each other. If you're ready for your horsemanship and horse riding to look like this, take the first step, click on the link in the show notes, and join us in our free masterclass, Say Yes to a Happy Willing Horse. Or you can find it over on our website at www.equestrianmovement.com/sayyes. Until next week, happy trails.